Welcome to Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. It's like coffee with an analyst, but there's no actual coffee. Each episode, we interviewed an expert in the field of law enforcement analysis to share their career-defining stories and to get their insights on the world. Please join us on recognizing and learning from these brilliant minds as we define the law enforcement analysis profession one episode at a time.
Thank you for joining me. I hope many aspects of your life are progressing. My name is Jason Alder, and today our guest has 15 years of law enforcement analysis experience. He is an intelligence analyst and a crime analyst. He is currently the IACA's conference chair. He's the California kid who took his talents to Henderson, Nevada. Please welcome Albert Mesa. Albert, how are we doing?
Doing good. How are you, Jason?
I am doing well. So just like all the interviews lately, in the beginning, we go back in time. So I think I'm going to treat you the same. So let's go back in time to Albert, the college student who's an accounting major and then decides to get into criminal justice field and become an analyst.
All right. I was in college to be an accounting major. However, that changed while I was going to college and also working for the Sheriff's Department in Ventura County. I ended up getting a job there while attending school because of the flexible schedule. And during that time, I was helping the crime analyst that was assigned to the Major Crimes Division on a couple of cases that we had had, and she needed help with data entry and those types of lower level tasks that a student aide could work on. I kind of thought it was interesting how she was able to work in law enforcement but not be a sworn person, as my dad was a sworn person, and I never really wanted to be that kind of, didn't want that profession. It was a lot of sacrifice, and I decided, you know what, I'm just going to do my own thing and go into the accounting. But while working in major crimes, I had a family member that was unfortunately the victim of a homicide, and that really changed my outlook on my career and what I wanted to do with my skills as an analytical person. And because I was able to sit with that crime analyst, her name was Debbie Hernandez, I'll never forget that she explained, hey, this is how I got into the profession. I got certified through Cal State Northridge, which is in California, and I literally signed up the next weekend at that college. And after my cousin was murdered, and here I am today. I never looked back.
Oh, wow. Just if you could, what are some of the details of your cousin being murdered?
So it was the day before his birthday. And at the time he was living in a city called Oxnard, which is in Ventura County. And during that time, they had been experiencing a lot of violent crime in the city. One night, somebody knocked on his door. He was at home with his girlfriend and his one-year-old son. Somebody knocked on the door and the girlfriend opened it, and a person started trying to get into the apartment. So he came up behind her, tried to push the guy out of the doorway, and he ended up reaching in and shooting a gun off and hitting him three times. And unfortunately, he succumbed to his injuries later on at the hospital.
So that was that just a home invasion robbery, or what was the motive?
You know, we never found that out. We had always thought maybe it was a gang initiation or maybe like wrong identity type thing. However, the case went unsolved for over 10 years. It wasn't until about, I want to say about 3 years ago, they finally closed it. A family member of the suspect came forward and provided information. Unfortunately, by the time that this came to light, the suspect had committed suicide about 5 years prior to that. So he was never put through the criminal justice system. However, at least there was some closure for my family.
Oh, I'm really sorry about that, Albert. Wow. So then, you know, this drives you to get into the profession. You eventually take over for the lady that you were working for, correct?
That's correct. So at the time, I was going through the crime analysis certification program in California, finished it. I was also going to college, trying to get my bachelor's degree, and a position opened up at the Thousand Oaks Station, which is a contract city for Ventura County, and ended up working there first as a new analyst, and eventually made my way to major crimes about, I think, a year and a half later. And yeah, I kind of stepped into her role after she left, and it was the best position I ever had.
Are you always seem to have done a mixture of intelligence analysis work and crime analysis work. Can you kind of describe that concept, how you've done both over the years?
Sure. So I think like most analysts, you know, we get called crime analysts. However, there's always that piece of intelligence analysis that we do. We just don't get credit for it in our job title. Even working as a station analyst as my first position, I worked a lot of tactical analysis for patrol. However, that intel piece comes into it when you're trying to focus on people that are constantly causing problems in the community or repeat offenders, looking at who else they're involved with. Got a little taste of that at the station level, but really dug deep into it when I got to the major crimes position and into other subsequent analyst positions at other agencies.
What crimes are normally included with major crimes?
So I was assigned to mostly violent crime. It was homicides, robberies. For whatever reason, we used to have quite a few abductions, kidnappings in our area, which was kind of interesting. Mostly those types of crimes. And Ventura County is a pretty safe area. We don't get too many of them. However, when we do get cases, they were usually pretty good ones, or there were cases that were high profile and everybody was kind of watching them. So I really got to experience a lot of cool cases from a very, very early stage of my career.
So then you get clearances throughout your career. You got an FBI top secret clearance. Was that something that the department paid for, or how did you go about getting that? Because that's one topic that we haven't really discussed on the show, is the idea of a clearance.
Yes. So when I left Ventura County Sheriff, I took a position with the Glendale Police Department in California, which was ironically funny because they always got me and Brian Hill confused. And I used to get calls. I used to get calls all the time about asking if I could, they could speak to Brian Hill. I'm like, you have the wrong Glendale. It was always a joke between the both of us. But while I was at Glendale PD, I was assigned to the Eurasian Organized Crime Task Force. And at that time, they were focusing a lot of investigation and time towards the Armenian Power Group that was kind of located in the area. There was a huge FBI task force that was part of that investigative team, and it required me to get a FBI top secret clearance. The department did sponsor it and paid for it, and it is very expensive. I remember it was several thousand dollars, and it was a great experience to have because I was able to go to the Los Angeles FBI field office to go see how they operated in their analysis units, got to see how they did wires. And it opened up my eyes to a lot of other ways that analysts can help on a case.
And then how long did a top secret clearance take to obtain?
So basically, you know, we all go through backgrounds to get hired on at a police department. Basically had to do another background with the FBI. You fill out a packet. I didn't have to do a polygraph or anything like that, but I did get interviewed by some random FBI agent that called me from Washington, D.C. to ask me about all these personal questions, which was kind of funny. It's a little awkward, but, you know, you have to trust that it's an FBI agent on the phone.
What kind of questions were they?
Oh, God. They go into your whole background about things you answered on your personal history statement and things I did as a teenager and, you know, a young adult. And, you know, it's very intrusive, but, you know, it's part of the plan. And luckily I didn't do too many bad things as a young person growing up in a law enforcement house. So it wasn't too bad. It was actually pretty easy. And the crazy part is that it's only good for like 5 years. And then you have to keep renewing it and doing like updates to get to keep the clearance.
Yeah, it was funny. When I saw that on your resume, I was just like, oh, I remember I got a secret clearance, top secret clearance back in 2005. And I thought that clearance was going to change my life career-wise. I really did. I thought, oh, once I get this top secret clearance, you know, I'm going to be able to pick it from the litter of jobs. I was living in Baltimore. I was like, oh, DC, I can just pick whatever job I want to once I get that top secret clearance. As you can guess, that's not how it worked. So
I can see that. I mean, you think you kind of know you're special, but all I really had to show for it was this like really ugly brown FBI badge that you get. Oh, man. that allows you to get into some of the buildings. And inside the Glendale Police Department, there was other offices you had to get into, and you had to use that key card to get in, which was pretty interesting. But yeah, I can see that. I mean, especially because you see on jobs for the federal government, you know, desired qualification, secret clearance or top secret clearance.
So when you get to the FBI training center there, what were you most shocked about, or what really stood out?
To be honest, the building was very old. Uh-huh. It was the I want to say it's the Hoover Building. It's right there on Wilshire Boulevard. It's used in tons of TV shows and stuff like that. You always recognize that big white building. And I do remember going in there, and I'll never forget, they have a wall of all the fallen FBI agents on the wall. Mm-hmm. And I remember seeing that, just thought that was pretty interesting. You see it in law enforcement at the local level. It was interesting to see that at a federal level, and kind of reminds you that, you know, even as federal partners, you know, they do lose people in the line of duty as well. And very nice people at the FBI. And I'll be honest, I was kind of like you. I was like, I want to be an intel analyst for the FBI, and I want to get out of, you know, get into the federal and go like work in Bogota somewhere and, you know, be these cool positions. But it was a lot of reading and writing, and I wasn't really down for that. I like getting into the weeds and working cases. And by that time, it was kind of post 9/11. So it was the intel analyst job had changed quite a bit. And being there and seeing that, it kind of really set it in motion where I was like, yeah, I don't want to go to the federal route. diss to any of the other federal people, but you know, it just wasn't my thing.
Did you learn cell phone analysis techniques from them as well?
I didn't learn cell phone techniques from FBI. I started working cell phone cases while I was assigned to that task force. And it was the first time I'd ever really worked with cell phone data. It was from an FBI system, which was interesting. It was from there, you know, for people who work wire cases, usually most people have PenLink, which is the system they use. The FBI has their own version of that. And it's not the most friendly, and I didn't have access to pull the data from it. So every time I got a download from an agent, it was usually something different. The headers never matched, and I swear it was like a DOS system that they used to pull out the data. It was a challenge to really figure out what that data meant and how to use it. I had never trained on that.
What types of cases are you working at and this time?
In Glendale, so we're mostly working organized crime, a lot of corruption type cases, trying to follow the people, follow the money. I worked a lot of passport cases where people were falsifying passports and using them to get into the U.S., which was, it opened up my mind because I'm not used to those types of cases coming from a smaller, you know, agency where your biggest thing is a burglary series, you know, or maybe a homicide that I worked on. So this was just way out of my comfort zone in terms of, you know, how do I support an investigation like that?
So if you're having difficulty with the FBI data, what are you using then to keep all the data organized?
At that time, it was a lot of Access, Microsoft Access, and Excel spreadsheets, because basically you got a download and it was in a text file. It was comma separated, and you know, bringing it to Excel and try to work with it. And I had to bring it into Access eventually because those headers kept changing when they would do the downloads. So I couldn't keep using the same spreadsheet. And this was post like what we have, or pre Excel, that, you know, this was when it maxed out at like 66,000 records.
Oh boy. Yeah.
So, you know, you remember those days, I couldn't keep it in there. So
it amazes me when I think back about it. I was just like, how did we ever get along with 65,000 records?
I know, these new apps have no idea.
Yeah, it's just, you know, I'm old man elder here. I think back as like 65,000. I mean, that is not very large at all. And somehow we managed to do it. So then you leave all this, you leave California and go to Nevada. I mean, I guess what brought you to Nevada?
I had been in California, obviously, my entire life. I had worked at a couple agencies. I had left Glendale, went back to Ventura County Sheriff to be closer to family. And at the time, I had been working as a dispatcher, eventually got back into crime analysis when a position opened. At that time, things in my personal life changed. I got married, you know, just kind of started trying to think about the future. And California was just way too expensive to kind of keep trying to survive there. And you just, in my case, I felt like you could just never really get ahead. And at the time, Safa Eagle-Mez, who I'd worked with, and he was working for Santa Monica PD years ago when I had started my career in crime analysis, he had moved out to Henderson, Nevada, and he had been bugging me for years to come out. And I kept telling him he was crazy because, like, who wants to live in 110 degrees? And, you know, but when you get older, I guess you get, you know, kind of your perspective changes on things. They pay a lot more than I would get any paid in California, and there's no state income tax there. Who doesn't want to like be next to the casinos? And From all the connections and networking I had done through my, you know, years of being a crime analyst, I had met some people from Las Vegas. So I was like, hey, you know what? I'm going to just come out here. My wife was on board and she was ready for a change. So it was literally getting married and moving new jobs within like 2 months. You know, we did like the three most stressful things a person could go through in in a matter of a couple months, but it's really paid off since.
And you're doing similar work with Henderson Police Department, right? It's a telephone toll analysis, support and patrol operations, so on and so forth.
That's correct. So Henderson, our title is crime and intelligence analyst. So we focus on both sides of the house. We have analysts that are assigned to area commands. We will soon have an analyst assigned to investigations to really support kind of all areas of the police department. We still do the administrative functions with traffic analysis, and we did a DDACS project last year. So we're trying to see if we can continue to do that. We are kind of like Sally Terabaugh, where you're the jack of all trades. When you're at a smaller agency, you kind of have to do it all. And our agency is very data driven and understands the importance of not only data, but how the analyst fits into that piece.
Yeah. How big is Henderson?
So Henderson is population is about 330,000. It's a pretty decent sized city, and our population growth has been crazy because everyone's fleeing California and coming to Nevada.
So the Albert model.
Yeah, it's been crazy. We have it's more affordable here, and people are coming out like crazy, and there's a lot of businesses that are investing in there. You have Google has a data center here, and Amazon's building, and it's kind of the new place. But it brings challenges as a city as well, because we're not getting increased resources with all these people coming in.
Yeah, it's usually a little slower.
It is. It's kind of, as an analyst, I've started now working with community development quite a bit to when we start looking at places and how many people we're expecting, or we're looking at, we're adding a new substation in the next 2 years. So we're looking at redistricting our boundaries, but this time we're trying to be smarter and use partners at the city that I would have never thought of before to figure out, you know, well, what's the plan for buildings or businesses? And they've been a treasure trove of data. It's amazing. And they have all these GIS layers and tools that we can use to make better analytical products in supporting the police department's decisions.
Yeah. Do you have a good example of that? Someone that's kind of off the wall?
Yeah, so we have a planner. He's the principal planner for the city, and he does his own projections on what population figures are going to look like based off of zoning on parcels. And he has a ratio of about the approximate average of people that would be living on a certain parcel based off of it's a multifamily type property or if it's a single family residence. And he's been amazing. I would have never thought to use that data in redistricting. He's part of our team now. He's part of our working group that we're just starting to meet to kind of go and start this project until it's final when the building gets completed.
Well, I guess, have you gotten used to that Nevada heat yet?
You know what? I keep telling myself, Jason, it's a dry heat.
That's what they always say.
It's true though, because we do get like the 2 week monsoon weather where it's a little humid, but it's nothing like Florida or the East Coast or Texas. Like when we go to conferences and you get off that airplane, because usually, you know, it's in August or September, I'm just like, I couldn't do it. The humidity kills me. Now when I go back to California, it's too humid.
Oh, very good. All right. Well, let's get into your badge story, because it's here in Nevada where you get your badge story, your career-defining moment.
I think most analysts were probably in my situation where you feel you're never going to get a badge story, or, you know, I feel like, okay, I've been working all these cases. I've been a crime analyst for like 10 years, and like I've never really done anything crazy like solve like a trucker serial rapist series or something cool like Sam Gwynn would do in VICAP. I was working here for less than a year, and we had a suspect that was going around and robbing convenience stores / gas stations. And ironically, they're called Terrible Earps. That's the name of the chain of the gas stations. This guy had been hitting for almost a year, and he was dubbed the Camo Bear. He was a pretty large guy, very heavy build, looked like a linebacker, and he wore a camouflage face mask when he would go into the store to do the robberies. He would take money, and he would take mostly cigars and or the little like Swisher Sweets type things. And he would slowly kind of just walk out of the convenience store, and we could never catch him. here in Henderson, we border right up against Las Vegas Metro, which is kind of the big fish in the pond here. And we have regional meetings, and, you know, basically the sheriff there was just like, you know, why can't we catch this guy? And, you know, he's been hitting for a year, and, you know, he's kind of like making us look dumb because we can't find him. So after that meeting, it was kind of like, you know, typical law enforcement's like, okay, assimilate the task force. And, you know, everyone gets involved and all the agencies are having meetings and providing their data and dates and times. And at the time, each of the agencies had done tower dumps, but nobody had really shared the data with anybody else, which is usually a common problem here. We have series that affect three different jurisdictions, but sometimes the information is not always shared. Finally, at this meeting, I'm like, hey, give me the tower dump data and let me take a look at it. So at the time, there was no cell phone tower dump analysis software that I trusted, that I felt could really, I didn't believe in just dumping the data and here's a phone number. I wanted to know how I came up with that number. So using Excel to clean up the data for each of the carriers and using Microsoft Access to create queries to match up these numbers, I found that there was a number that had been used in about 6 or 7 of the events. So I started doing research on the phone number, finally get a subscriber name, and then I run the name, pull up his driver's license photo. And I will never forget pulling up the driver's license photo. I'm like, oh my God, that's the dude. It's this weird feeling you get. I could not type fast enough that day, the email to the detectives to be like, hey, I think this is the guy. He looks like him. Here in Nevada, we track people's work permits quite a bit. So if you work in casinos or gas stations, they kind of have like a work card on file. Well, this guy had worked at Terrible Herbs before.
Oh.
So as I keep digging, it's like it keeps getting better and better. I'm like, oh my gosh, this has got to be the guy. And sent off the information to the detectives from the Henderson side and from the Las Vegas Metro side. And at that point, the chase was on to see who could get him first. Eventually, he was arrested during the commission of the 17th robbery and was taken into custody and totally admitted to everything. And when we had identified that phone number, the detective ended up writing like for his actual call detail records. So they came in at like 8:30 at night on a Friday, and detective texted me, and I went into work and to map them all. And I was there till like 2:30 in the morning trying to map all these incidents, and his phone record showed him at every single location. So it was pretty awesome. I don't know if I'll ever have a case like that in my career, but I'm glad I was able to do that, because that's been my goal my entire career, is like after with my cousin, is like, if I could just solve one case or identify one person, then to me, it's all worth it. That was kind of my defining moment as an analyst.
Then when you said he got caught on the 17th robbery, then had you guys gotten to the point now where you were tracking him, or how did he get caught doing his 17th robbery?
So in true, you know, multi-jurisdictional task force fashion, there was an agreement on how he should be taken down. One agency was like, hey, we have all this cell phone data that shows him at all these locations that like he's like good to go. Let's just go arrest him. Where the other agency was like, well, like we want to catch him like red-handed doing a robbery. So that was going on. And at that point, I'm like, well, I'm out of it. You know, I already gave you my information. It's up to them to figure out how they're going to take him into custody, because during these robberies, you know, he actually had a firearm. And when he got arrested, he had a firearm on him, and he's a pretty big guy. So it's not like it was an easy arrest. So luckily nobody got hurt, and he, you know, didn't cause any problems when he was arrested.
You said he worked at some of these places. He had some kind of inside information, I'm taking, on how to rob each one of these stores.
Yeah, it's funny you asked that. During his, you know, his interview or / confession with our detectives, he basically admitted that when he worked at one of these places, that he was the worker when the store got robbed. Oh. And he basically stole that guy's MO. And he's like, well, you know, and the unfortunate part is that he was doing all these robberies because he fell on financial hardship, and he had a wife and he had kids, and he felt he had to do this in order to apparently sustain himself. However, you know, like most of the stuff, like I said, he was taking was like cigarettes and like those types of things. But I thought that was funny, is that he basically got the idea because he was technically one of the victims at one of these robberies. He's like, you know what, I'm going to do it now.
Yeah, that guy's pretty smart. Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah, I was like, hey,
Yeah, so that is kind of funny that he's fallen on hard times, but then what is he stealing? Like $20 worth of stuff or whatever it is? What's the take in some of these robberies?
Yeah, he wasn't getting away with very much. In fact, I don't think he really took that much money. He always asked for cigarettes, like those little fake cigars. I don't know. They're called cigarillos, I think is what they call them. He would take menthol cigarettes was his thing. But he wasn't getting away with like hundreds of dollars. You know, most of these convenience stores now, everyone uses cards. These places don't even carry that much cash anymore. It was just interesting. We could never find him afterwards, but he would park down the street like several blocks, park his car, and he would walk to the store. So by the time the police get there, I always found it funny that they could never find him like leaving because he was such a, you know, he didn't walk very fast, you know? So it was just an interesting case, and it was awesome.
For those that maybe forget, not everybody walked around with a mask on back then, right?
No, not everybody walked around with the mask. I know it's totally making it way harder to identify people now with these, with the COVID mask that everyone's wearing.
All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, I want to get into your new role as a manager, get into IACA. You're listening to Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Kyle Stoker, and I'm encouraging you to vote in the IACA elections. So it's a little bit of a confusing process, but between August and September, nominees need to get nominated. So there's a nomination process where they have to get 2% of the membership, and then voting actually starts on October 1st. So for the entire month of October, you have the opportunity to vote for your final candidate. So make sure you go to the IACA website and vote, because our membership has a voice in who leads the organization, and you want to make sure that your voice is heard. Thank you very much.
Hi, this is Steve French, and I have a little phrase for you to remember. A phrase that stuck with me throughout my time as an analyst is a quote from Sherlock Holmes. When you've eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth.
Welcome back. Before the break, Albert was telling us about his camo bear badge story, which is a fascinating story of a person stealing cigarettes and beef jerky, basically. Now, you recently have got promoted to manager, and it was actually during COVID. So it was just past April. So first of all, congratulations on your promotion.
Thank you.
Talk a little bit about that, because this is obviously from the police department. COVID has been an odd experience for them, probably just like everybody else, but just kind of take us through a little bit of March into April, COVID, and then getting promoted.
Yeah, so I think like most agencies and analysts, they've been affected differently with COVID. Luckily, actually up until recently at the time, Novata didn't really have high numbers, especially in Henderson. So since the beginning of COVID, we have been coming into the office telecommuting part-time. So during this time, we're also down to analysts. During this time as well, promotional opportunity came about in the police department, and I put in for it and was given the opportunity to be the supervisor of the unit. At the time, it's kind of a weird balance where you're a supervisor and you're responsible for, you know, managing the day-to-day operations of the unit. But because we're understaffed, I'm also having to be a working analyst and still being an individual contributor and still being responsible for somewhat of a workload for investigations and area command. Kind of a challenging time. And, you know, this was my first official supervisory position or role within an analyst unit. I'm also trying to get my bearings on, you know, how I want to be a leader and how I want to move the unit forward. Just kind of working my way through that during COVID, when there's like less people in the building, and, you know, there's less meetings going on, there's less contact, and it does pose a different challenge to getting acclimated to a new position.
So then your unit, when it's at full strength, how many analysts will you be supervising?
So I will have 4 full-time crime and intelligence analysts, and I have 2 part-time staff, and I was supposed to get a 5th full-time crime analyst position, an additional one, but then COVID hit and kind of, unfortunately, they scrapped it and told me I have to wait until they have extra money.
And then were you the only one running for the position?
I was the only one that ran for the position internally. It was open to the outside. So okay. There was external candidates that had also put in for it.
How has it been going from coworker analyst to supervisor of your coworkers?
It's a little weird sometimes. You know, I don't think it's an easy transition for anybody in any position. You know, you look at the sworn side and they kind of deal with the same type of challenge. You know, they all start as officers, but eventually they may be supervising their really good friends or academy mates. And luckily, I have a really strong team. They're the best people I've ever had the chance to work with. Very mature, very skilled. And I think at the end of the day, everyone's professional and there to do the job. And I luckily don't have to deal with a lot of the challenges or the bad things that sometimes supervisors have to deal with. So I appreciate that. My team has been so awesome and they've been really helpful in transitioning from that coworker to a supervisor.
Well, just a shameless plug here. The podcast just published a hiring guide, Sean Bear's Guide to Hiring a Law Enforcement Analyst. So I encourage you to check it out because there's advice in there from Sean on setting goals, setting expectations, hiring, setting the expectations. There was a good conversation that we had in there in particular, helping employees establish their goal when they don't know what they want to do, where they want to go. So, which seems funny, but a lot, some people just don't know what they want to do in 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, right?
Yeah, it's true. I'm actually looking forward to listening to that because I think most professional staff in law enforcement, a lot of us don't get a lot of that leadership guidance or mentoring in an official capacity. And you kind of have to find your way through it or hopefully you know another analyst who's been there, done that. You can kind of count on them to go for advice. And what would you do in this situation? And we actually just opened, I have another opening, you know, to hire the fourth person. It opened yesterday and going through the process now, it's like I see things from a different perspective. I technically get that people are going to have a set of skills coming into an interview. You know, our profession is still on a smaller scale where, you know, there's not that many of us. But now I'm looking more of the personality fit because that personality will make or break the team, you know, even though someone might be highly skilled and be really smart, but if they don't have a good attitude or they're not willing to share information, you know, they may not be that great of a cohesive part of the team.
Is there a particular skill set that you're looking for?
I am. So I am looking more for a candidate who has some GIS skills because I have a lot of projects that I want to get done. Unfortunately, during COVID, we've been going through an RMS upgrade. So that's not been very fun either. And once it's completed, I have a bunch of GIS dreams and hopes for automation and trying to create more self-service analytics. So the analysts aren't being bogged down with all these minor ad hoc requests so they can focus on higher level analytical products.
It's funny. I had Chris Bruce on here a couple of weeks ago, and he was telling me that he's run into departments where they don't even have GIS and they're just using either Google Maps or they're using some sub program off their RMS to just put the dots on the maps.
Some of these agencies probably can't afford the software or don't have someone that's got the technical skills to use the program to its full ability. I mean, I've listened to some of the other, you know, sessions of the podcast and I can tell that you're not the biggest fan of the mapping program. So I think all of us have been at that point where, you know, I learned on ArcMap 3.2. Yeah. And I just, you know, it's come a long way since. And to me, it's gotten a lot more intuitive, but I still have my challenges too, because I am not a GIS analyst. I'm not in the program every day. And, you know, if you don't use it, you lose it. I mean, yeah. I just made a map yesterday and I hadn't touched the software in like 3 months.
Yeah. No, I don't know what it is. I swear at that program more than any other in my whole career. Like it just always did. It always crashed on me. Just the simplest things always gave me a hard time. And maybe if I was classically trained in it, it might have been better for me. But oh, did I swear at that program. If I probably could have picked it up and thrown the program, I probably would have done it several times.
I think that's most analyst experience. I don't think you're the only one. Most of us haven't gone through formalized training. I mean, CMAP, I went to one class ever for GIS, and it was a CMAP class that Stacy Belden was teaching. After that, I've never had any formalized training on ArcGIS, and that's why it was important for me to bring it to the conferences.
Yeah. Now, it almost makes me wonder if we as a profession are getting the most out of the software.
When I was making that map yesterday, I was doing a kernel density map on some calls for service data. And I turned to one of my analysts and I was like, do you think we'll ever use all these tools in the ARC toolbox? Because I feel like I use like two of them and there's like 200 of them. And yeah. It's just like, it's such a powerful program, but I agree. I don't think that most analysts are using it to its full potential. And maybe we'll get there someday with more training and as it kind of improves. I mean, the new version of this ARC Pro has like a crime analysis toolbar in there now, which makes things so much easier that used to take forever in the older version. So I think as long as our profession kind of keeps that stronghold on changing technology, I think it'll get easier.
You know, another topic that I like to talk about is RMS systems. So you started a working group for those implementing new CAD and RMS systems.
Yes, it's at the very beginning. I'm trying to get together a working group because it's been my kind of my little pet peeve of these companies that buy out other companies and, you know, analysts are left with these systems that A, don't collect the data that they need. And if they do collect the data, it's like a challenge to get the data out. Just from my experience recently, it's most of these companies or vendors are now like, you have to like be an SQL master to be able to pull your data out and create reports, or else, you know, the days of connecting your Access database through ODBC to your backend is kind of going away. It's a shift in our profession where it's like now you're kind of expected to know SQL or R or some of these other programming languages, and which is technically its own profession, its own position.
Although so, I will say that though that working in SQL and writing your own code in the backend database is usually faster. It's more powerful program that you're using as compared to Access. But it is the learning curve, probably something you should get into anyway, because you definitely want to get into the back end of the data. You don't want to be working with the front end of just the fields that the reports are going to give to you, because you won't have all the data.
I completely agree. It's something that analysts are going to have to start embracing. The challenge, I think, though, is that departments, you know, you fight with your IT people, and I had to like fight to get some stuff installed on our computers. We needed Microsoft SQL Server Management Studio. And they're like, well, why do you need that? And it's like, because we need to write these statements and it's not the easiest to do it in the native, in Microsoft Report Builder. And, you know, I know some analysts that work at departments, they're not even allowed to have Microsoft Access on their computers. When there's limitations being thrown at you and this is coming on board, I think it's kind of a shift in the way we operate.
I sure hope so. I've not been shy with arguing with IT staffs in my career either, for that matter, because I found it fascinating. I think probably before this year, how many people were probably told that they can't do any work from home. Right. And then all of a sudden, you know, everybody's working from home. I used to fight constantly for admin rights on the machine and not have to come to them every time I wanted to demo a new software or try to figure out if a new software would help us out and do some research and development. So it's still sad to hear that somebody can't have something like, you know, Microsoft Access, which is an Office product. I sure hope that it gets better for analysts, because they should be able to do R&D. They should be able to get different software on their machines to help them do the job.
I agree. And I'm hoping that with this working group, you know, analysts can talk to each other, say, hey, you know, I'm getting this kind of resistance from my IT people. What have you done? Even with our IT people, we have great IT people, to be honest, and they're just as overworked and understaffed like everybody else. And they have these enormous projects they're working on. And it was just really a type of conversation where it's like, look, like we have to get our data out. We need this tool, or else guess who's going to have to write these reports? It's going to be you guys. And you guys have enough work, so you guys can take this on too. And, you know, at that point they're like, okay. And, you know, I think they were more worried that we were going to like delete data, and we don't have any live production databases that we touch. So we're like, you know, it'll be fine. We all know what we're doing. We're experienced professionals and know we get the concept that, hey, you know, you have to be careful when you're accessing some of these databases. But, you know, I remember taking one of your SQL classes years ago and just like thinking like, well, when am I ever going to use this? You know, I just do it this way. And it's like, yeah, how funny now.
Yeah.
You know, what I'm doing is I'm signing up for a class here at the community college, an intro to programming, because I really want to learn more about it, even though I'm a supervisor.
No, it's good to know. I mean, even if you're just asking the data questions, getting in there and trying to figure out what the data is. But that's more on the intel side piece, right? If you're searching through all your data sets and searching for particular keywords or a particular set of data.
Correct.
Well, good. And then you have a leadership working group that you're also a part of, right?
Yeah, that one it hasn't started yet. I'm trying to work with the IACA. I haven't really flown the entire idea by Annie Mitchell yet, but you know, going through this experience of being promoted has really opened my eyes to, I think, a lack of preparation for analysts to kind of move up to that next level of being a supervisor or a manager or a director. I'm hoping that maybe this working group can kind of take some current managers and supervisors in our field and kind of come up with some kind of training curriculum for either other managers and supervisors that are newer like myself, or people that want to get into a supervisory role and bring some of that training and knowledge to our conferences and offer it as part of a track and a part of a working group, to kind of like the mentoring committee where you can like, hey, I'm a new supervisor. I don't know what I would do with this. I can call this other supervisor analyst that I know from the group and kind of get their take on something. And anything else now, I say you're never really alone. You always have that other person or other people to get their buy-in or get their opinion on something before you make a decision.
But these working groups, how do you communicate or how do you plan on meeting?
So that's the challenge now, because, you know, I was hoping to do stuff at the conference, but obviously that changed for this year. Mm-hmm. And that's where I was hoping to maybe kick it off. In Newport Beach, I had a RMS speed dating type presentation that I did. And it was just to kind of match people up with, hey, I have this RMS vendor and you have the same one. Let's talk to each other. Maybe we can share an SQL statement or a SQL statement, or maybe we can share a relationship diagram that the vendor wouldn't give it to me, but I have it. And, you know, that kind of a working relationship with each other to help each other out. And, you know, you start meeting all these people that can help you work with these different companies. My eventual goal is to like say, hey, we have this working group of everybody. And, you know, these 50 analysts have this one RMS system and they're being told, oh, it can't do that. Well, if we can leverage that working group to go to the vendor, be like, hey, these 50 agencies want this change. Maybe you should do it for free in the next upgrade. Because how many times do we get told, well, that's extra money because it's a customization, or that's currently not offered. And we get told, no one else has asked for that. That's my favorite. No one else has asked for that. Why would you want that? And those types of things. And that's kind of like my dream to really build that up after my conference duties are over.
All right. Well, I do want to get into the IACA, but let's take another break before we do that. When we come back, we'll talk about IACA, and then we'll get into your cars obsession.
Okay.
All right. This is Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Tony Berger. I want to encourage each and every one of you to refuse to be offended. We're living in a world right now where everybody's talking and divided on different issues, and we are on social media, and what happens invariably is that somebody says or types something that irks us, makes us mad. And I just want to encourage you to not take offense to what other people say. Sniping back and forth at people serves no purpose.
Hi, this is Sally Cherba. I'm here to tell you that nobody needs to know what first car you have, or what's your pet's name, or what street you grew up on. We all see these on Facebook and we all want to answer them. But keep in mind that there are people who are reading them, and they're going to go on your bank account and they're going to say, oh, I forgot my password. Let me reset it. And the bank's going to ask, what's the first street you lived on? What is your cat's name? And what color car did you own? And the person reading it, they're going to look through your question and they're going to answer and they're going to get access to your bank account. We call that social engineering. So next time you see that survey, that questionnaire, don't.
Welcome back. Before the break, Albert was talking about being promoted this spring and going from analyst to supervising fellow coworkers, and some great insight on that. I did want to get to IACA. You are currently the conference chair, and how many conferences have you been a chair of now?
Well, Chicago this year would have been my third year, but as most people know, it was canceled to COVID. And then I'm also the conference chair for next year, which is in Las Vegas.
Okay, your backyard.
Yes, it was originally to be my swan song. And now I don't know, with the way COVID is still affecting a lot of things, we'll see how that conference is going to move forward. But I think it's going to be a lot different.
Well, I guess let's start there with the cancellation of the conference. Just go through the process of deciding to cancel the conference when you did.
So me and Beth Glover, who's the vendor coordinator, she's amazing. We had just been in Chicago in March to do a site visit to start finalizing some of the space utilizations for vendors and for our classrooms. And at that time, I remember COVID had just started to hit, and like my Uber driver was freaking out about my germs, and I had coughed a little bit and she kind of got scared. And during that time, I'm like, oh, this doesn't look good. And then as time progressed, probably like in late April, you know, we started having some conversations with Annie Mitchell, who's the VP of administration. She's the conference committee liaison to the board. And we had to have some difficult conversations about the reality of how is this going to affect analysts' ability to come in person. And a lot of people thought, well, it's too early because we don't know, you know, it's, you know, the conference is in August and there's still a few months to go and it'll probably be over by then. I want to say it was towards the beginning of May. After many conversations, we made the choice to cancel the conference. And this was, it wasn't an easy decision. It was very hard. And we went back and forth between the conference committee, between the board, with the hotel, because we didn't know what was going on with them either. We just thought that it just wasn't going to work out. And we're glad that we made the decision back then, because there was no way we were going to be able to have the conference now. There was just no way. But it was, I'm not going to lie, it hurt to not have that conference. And I'm not the only one. There's a lot of us that have been going to these conferences for years. I haven't missed a conference since 2007, except for the Hyannis one. I was a dispatcher at the time, but you know, I make it a point to try to go to these conferences. And so do a lot of hardcore ICA members, where it's like the highlight of the year. We enjoy getting together for training and seeing each other. And it's literally like a second family to me. It was hard. It was really hard to cancel the conference. And I know it sounds so weird and you're like, oh, it's just a training conference. But for us, it's so much more than that. Especially we had such a successful year in National Harbor and in Newport Beach. And we're on this track where we're getting record attendance numbers. And it was just really unfortunate. And, you know, but at the end of the day, it's about everyone's health and safety. And we want people to be safe.
Everybody I've asked about the conference being canceled so far is, you know, they've made a point that they're not criticizing the decision. I don't think anybody's criticizing your decision. So I hope you don't feel in that regard there's regret or anything, because it's absolutely was the right decision. And then you hit on it, right? It is a family reunion to those people that go regularly. And there is something about it where you look forward to seeing the same people each and every year and catching up, visiting a new location and learning with like-minded people.
It is. And to me, the last conference we had in National Harbor, I know you joke and call yourself old man elder, but you know, I see such a change in our profession where there's this new generation of analysts coming in. And last year, 65% of our attendees were first-time conference goers. Mm-hmm. So there is a lot of new people in the profession that need training, need guidance, need networking. If there's a way to provide that, you know, at least while I'm heading up the conference committee, that's my favorite part about being the conference chair, because it is a lot of work, but it's so worth it to see everybody together, everybody enjoying their time, talking with vendors, meeting new people, and really making connections that they're hopefully going to have for the rest of their career, which sounds kind of cliche, but I know it's true because I've been able to experience that.
I guess in terms of the conference, it's a lot of work, right? I'm preaching to the choir there a little bit. I don't think somebody truly understands the amount of work you have to put into as conference chair. Can you try to describe how much work and effort it is to be the conference chair?
It is a lot of work. It's evolved over time, and prior conference chairs before me, I learned a lot from, and it's basically having a part-time job all year long. It's gone to the point now where our numbers are so high that there's never a break in the conference planning. We're constantly either planning the current conference, doing site visits for the next location, always something with the conference every month preparing and planning to get everything going, and been very blessed to have tons of amazing conference committee members that have been part of the group. And without those people, there's no way this conference would ever work. With some of the board members that we have now, they're very engaged and help a lot as well. It is a lot of work because there's a lot of unknowns. And every year when we go from a new conference chair to a new conference chair, there's a little bit of a knowledge transfer, but you're kind of like starting all over again and trying to event plan. I never did any of that before being the conference chair. Now I know more about hotel setups and theater seating and schoolroom seating and food and beverage minimums and tips. It's kind of crazy. If I ever retire from a crime analyst, I could totally be a hotel events planner. But it is an extreme amount of work that everybody on the conference committee puts in and is so dedicated to making it a success that it is a lot of work, but it doesn't feel like that sometimes. It's a lot of fun when we all get together, pull off a really great conference.
One of the other topics that Christopher Bruce and I talked about is the idea of IACA having paid positions, full-time paid positions that would handle some of these annual events, maybe even like the conference committee. What would your feelings on that be?
I mean, I can see where we could use some paid help on that because it is such a commitment to take on. However, I think people who are paid don't understand what makes up an ISA conference. And, you know, that can maybe be transferred over, but I kind of agree with that. Maybe it's because I have more of a personal bias because I've been part of the conference committee for so long, but I think there are certain things that we do outsource now already. So like the person who does all the work with looking for the locations to have the conferences at, the person who deals with the hotel, with the contract, with food and beverage, with hotel nights, that person is a professional in her own area. So she deals with all that. Basically, the rest of us come in and have control over who the speakers are going to be, what keynote speakers we want, those types of things that a person who's paid isn't really going to understand. You'd have to have someone guiding them anyway. So at that point, I'd rather do it myself. Because especially if it was like, well, why am I going to pay someone if I have to guide them and show them how to do certain things? But I can see, I think it's a half and half. And since Newport Beach, we started using outside vendors to help out with things like registration. Like we changed the way we do the badges. Before, when I used to be on the committee, it was waiting to as late as possible to get as many registrants. And then you'd see me running off to the nearest Kinko's trying to print out people's badges the day before. And now we have cool iPads that people come in, put their name in, and you can print on the spot. You can change things. It has the cool graphics. That has really eased a lot of the conference pain points. So that has helped out and gotten a lot better, but it's still always going to require some kind of involvement from people from the group, from the association.
I think you and me, in terms of the conference, we are infatuated with how much things cost, or I should say how much hotels charge. Right. I was flabbergasted last year when basically a sandwich lunch cost $50 a box, and it was a sandwich, a bag of chips, and I think a cookie and a drink. That cost $50 a lunch. And you're like, well, that's not anything, Jason. So what are some of your favorite ones over the years of ridiculous prices?
I totally forgot about that. You just mentioned that right now. If I remember that, it was, you're like, oh my God, it's so much money. I'm like, that's a drop in the bucket, dude. I mean, I think the first time I ever gassed during like a meeting with the hotel when I was looking through the food and beverage, you know, menu, and I was kind of just cruising along, and then I saw like, I kind of gassed. I was like, oh my God, $120 for a gallon of coffee? And it wasn't even Starbucks coffee. It was some unknown brand. And I was like, $120 for a gallon of coffee. Where have we gotten to in America where it costs $120 for coffee? And at every conference, you always have the certain people that still like to complain about things. And, you know, one of the complaints is like, well, why isn't there to-go coffee cups? And I'm like, I'll tell you why there's no to-go coffee cups, because it costs a lot of money to refill those coffee holders. And then you see people leaving their to-go cups full of coffee. We're like, well, there's $60 and there's $40. And I think those are some of the things that people don't realize. We provide a lunch during the week at the conference, and most of those lunches are costing between like $30,000 to $40,000. And it's included in your registration. And I've worked really hard with the board to try to keep the registration price at $500 for our members. And that price hasn't increased in years. You know, that's something that we're proud of, is that we're still able to offer the same amount of training and kind of the perks of coming to the conference, your swag bags and all those types of things, with keeping in with the inflation over the years. And, you know, the prices of hotel costs keep going up every year. Every year that I go on a site visit, I'm like, oh my gosh, now coffee's this much here. And people don't know either that the hotel slaps on not only sales tax, but a 18% service charge on top of all that.
Yeah.
So it can get very pricey very quick.
I will say this, though. I do miss the days of having the hospitality suite in a hotel room and filling up the tub with like beer and soda. And I think the one year you had a margarita machine. I mean, it was...
Yeah. So prior to being the conference chair, when I was on the conference committee, I used to be kind of in charge of the nights out. Yeah. So margarita machine was in Scottsdale, Arizona during that conference. And then I'm glad you remember the beer in the bathtub. That was in Arlington in 2010 when we co-hosted with the pop group. I don't even know where we got the trash can from. It just filled it up with ice and dumped it in the bathtub. It was fun.
I mean, it was basically going back to college and going to a frat party in there, and it was a good time.
It is, but. And that's where a lot of the networking happens, and that's where you get to meet people. And I mean, it is fun. People have drinks and stuff like that. But I think what you get out of that is the relationships and the friendships you make and seeing people at those events. Unfortunately, we had to stop doing hospitality night because of the hotel, the way the hotel policies are nowadays. We just can't afford to do that. And it's too much of a liability.
So do you have a favorite conference?
Oh, I do have a favorite conference. It was the year that I didn't have to do anything for it. And it was 2008. It was the St. Pete Beach, Florida conference.
That's my favorite conference too, for the exact same reason. That was my first one. I didn't have any responsibility. I wasn't teaching. I wasn't on any committees or anything. That's funny.
That was the best conference ever. And shout out to Erica Jackson, because I think she was the conference chair for that event. And I enjoyed that the classes were great, but that was kind of the year that I really solidified a lot of friendships with people and just met a bunch of, really took the time to like try to talk to other analysts from other departments and go up to people and talk to them, ask them their stories. And I truly get excited about hearing about other people and what they're doing and just asking them all kinds of stuff. And that was the year that I really got to do that, because as much as I love, you know, being the conference chair, there is kind of a sacrifice too, because I don't get to go to, I haven't been to an IACA training class in years, and I rarely get to stop and talk with people. You know, usually I'm running back and forth to do stuff. And usually at the end of the night, like, I'm too tired to even go out. I just kind of hide away in my room. So, you know, that conference was amazing.
Yeah, it was. That was when we had like the impromptu karaoke night.
The
little hut was just having a karaoke night, and we totally took it over that night. Yes, that's my favorite conference as well. So that's funny that we have the same one for the same reasons. So let's finish up then, because your personal interest is your obsession with cars. So let's get into that, because you have a couple stories there, just how you got into it and how it actually eventually won you a steak dinner.
Yeah, I have been obsessed with cars since I could hold a Hot Wheels toy. I don't know where it came from, but the ironic part is that I couldn't tell you how a car works, or I don't know how to work on a car, but I enjoy driving them. I am a enthusiast at heart. I still have a manual transmission, which is getting harder and harder to find these days. Mm-hmm. But it's something that I've always enjoyed. I like going to car shows, and I like reading about the future vehicles that are coming out. And I have like subscriptions to Motor Trend and some of the other car magazines. I follow a bunch of like Instagram accounts that talk about vehicles. And it's just always something that I've been involved with. And, you know, my dad is a big car person too. It's probably where I got it from. And it's come to help out in my career, because, you know, it's never failed where they're like, you get an email like, hey, can someone help identify what kind of car this was? Because it left the scene of a burglary or whatever. And I'm like, oh, that's like a 2005 Buick LeSabre. And usually it's pretty spot on. And since my early days as an analyst, I've always been known for being able to identify vehicles. Like, even when you get a grainy surveillance footage, which is most of them, and I've gone pretty good at it. And it did win me steak dinner when I was working in Glendale. We had a really bad robbery, a street robbery, and there was a camera that caught a vehicle speeding through an alley. And it was maybe about 2-3 seconds of vehicle clip because it was going so fast. And I had a lieutenant arguing with me. He was like, "That's a Honda Accord. It's a Honda Accord." And I'm like, "No." I go, that looks like a Cadillac Sotera, which is like 2 years that Cadillac made this car. And I'm like, "That's what that is." And he's like, "No, it's not." And they ended up finding the suspects in the vehicle that I had told them. So I got a free steak dinner at Damon Steakhouse there on Brand Boulevard in Glendale. It was pretty glorious.
How do you feel that you are able to identify all the characteristics and know them? Because I was always amazed when my dad used to tell me what a 57 Chevy was looked like. And I was like, "Wow, how'd you know the year?" But, you know, back in the day, they made 57. They didn't make them every year, right? Now they're making models every year in different styles and whatnot. How do you think you're able to be so keen on identifying, especially the year?
It's hard to get the exact year all the time, but I kind of play this game when I'm driving. I kind of look at different cars and I kind of say in my mind, "Oh, that's a this, that's a this." And when I was a dispatcher, I'd always look at plates and practice saying them in the phonetic alphabet so I wouldn't, you know, it would just be second nature when I was working. And I think that helps out quite a bit. If I'm really stuck on, "Oh, I don't know what year that would be." Here's a tip for all you analysts. If you're ever in question of a vehicle year, you can put in like Honda Accord wiki, and usually someone's got some kind of Wikipedia page about a Honda Accord, and it has like all the generations in it, and it kind of helps you narrow down the years because it has pictures and stuff like that. So the other thing too that I've done before is I've actually called dealerships to be like, "Hey, I have this picture, like, can you kind of tell me or help me narrow down the year on it?" And they've actually been very helpful before.
Well, that's a good tip. And actually, a good friend of mine runs a website for concept cars. It's conceptcarswithaz.com.
Oh, I'll have to check it out.
And yeah, definitely check it out. That's his full-time job, is running that website. He's done very well for himself, but he travels to the different car shows, takes pictures, and he's got the press pass and talk shop. And I know he's got a lot of information on auction data. So what people are getting at the auctions for different cars. So
that's interesting.
It's really nice website. He's done a good job.
Yeah, so check it out. I just went to one of the Mecum auto auctions that they have all around the country, but they had one here at the Mandalay Bay. So I went to my dad with that. And that was pretty interesting to see how they auction off vehicles. Something I hadn't done before, but we made the point to actually go see it, and it was totally cool.
All right. Our last segment is Words to the World. This is where you can promote any idea. Albert, what are your words to the world?
My words would be to make it a point to go out and meet people and network. That has been the biggest help in my career. And it's something that's for free. It's something that only you can do. It is what has been able to get me from being a novice analyst to an analyst where I may not know everything, but I know someone who does know it. And to me, that is a powerful tool. It's a powerful weapon. It makes you a better analyst. The more that you network and meet different people, the more open your world to analysis, or you're opening yourself up to a bigger group of people that can help you out in your career. Make it a point to always network with someone, meet someone new. When you're at a conference next time, tell yourself, "Hey, I'm going to meet 5 new people at this conference and get their information." That would be my challenge to every analyst in the ISCA.
Very good. Well, I leave every guest with, "You've given me just enough to talk bad about you later." But I do appreciate you coming on the show with me, Albert. Thank you for being on the show, and you be safe.
Thank you, Jason.
Thank you for joining us today on Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. We hope you not only enjoyed the show, but also learned something new. For more information on our guests and information relating to today's topic, please visit our website at leapodcast.com. Special thanks to The Rough and Tumble for our theme song. For more of their music, you can visit their website at theroughandtumble.com. Also, thanks to Kyle McMullen for our show logo. For more of his design, please visit his website at moderntype.com. The show is hosted, recorded, and edited by Jason Alder, and written by me, Mindy. You can contact us both via the LEA Podcast website. Please join us again next time as we interview another expert in this great field.